I'm a little confused after that ride over from Baltimore. Did you ever see such a hideous boulevard in your life?
I suppose there are boulevards just as terrible, but I'd never have seen any. No, no, it's a disgrace to humanity without question.
Why?
Well, because it represents the American lust for the hideous, the delight in ugliness for its own sake. It's very appropriately, it leads to the capital of the United States.
I remember you using that phrase quite often when you wrote for the Sun papers, the American libido for the ugly.
Yeah.
That was a favorite topic.
Yeah. Well, the idea in that was this, that such horrible exhibitions are not due to mere ignorance and innocence. There is a positive delight in the ugly. If you go down the street in Baltimore in those endless rows of two-story houses on a summer night, you can look in them. They're usually illuminated more or less. And you notice you'll go sometimes for two or three blocks without seeing a single object that's not hideous. Not a single thing. Not even a picture on the wall or a carpet or a rug. Then all of a sudden, you'll see in even the meanest neighborhoods a house very tastefully decorated.
Such as your house at 1524 Holland?
No, mine is not one, but there is a colored woman that lived in the alley behind me who in a little four-room house, did a swell job of decorating.
You were born in one of those two-story row houses, weren't you?
Yeah, I was born in Lexington Street in Baltimore near Fremont.
Mm-hmm. And you still live in one of those two-story houses?
No, it's three-story.
Three-story, well.
It was three-story, the one I was born into. My father bought the house I'm at present living in 1883.
That's a mark of great success in a Baltimorean when he's born in a two-story house and works up to live in a three-story house.
Yes, yeah, that is. But I had, unfortunately, didn't come up from that log cabin. My misfortune was that my father was relatively well off. It's been a curse to me all my life. Nobody will believe me on that ground. It seems to be the idea in America that no man is worth listening to unless he's had some experience in sweatshops.
What are your earliest recollections of Baltimore as a boy?
Well, I've written a book describing them. My first recollection is of the Oriole Parade in Baltimore in 1883. I've been told by psychologists and other such frauds that you couldn't possibly recollect anything that early. I was 3 years old precisely. But I remember it. I recall it very distinctly. And it wasn't told to me. Baltimore, I knew as a boy, was extraordinarily hot in summer and filthy. It was full of flies, mosquitoes. All kinds of epidemics were running simultaneously, but the people liked it. Food was cheap, houses were comfortable, although we slept under mosquito nets, and I look back on it with great affection. I realized its limitations. There were no sewers, and water supply was bad. Typhoid raged all summer, smallpox all winter, malaria at all times of the year. I had malaria, but I escaped typhoid and smallpox. How, I don't know. I think I escaped smallpox by a vaccination. The family doctor, old Dr. Wiley, vaccinated me when I was about 2 years old, and the scar was so enormous that it's still big as a half dollar on my arm, and no vaccination that I've ever had since has taken, as they say. I've been told that that's no proof of anything, but nevertheless, there is the fact.
What school did you go to?
I went to a school kept by an old German named Friedrich Knapp, known to Americans as Knapp. The school was down in Holiday Street, where the war memorial is now. And it was a private school. I went there till I was 12 years old, and then I transferred to Polytechnic.
That's a high school?
Yeah. I never got beyond the Polytechnic. I graduated at the Polytechnic very early. I was only 15. And never went to school since, thank God. Most men that escaped college have a regret that pursues them. But I must confess I'm much too vain to have any such regrets. I think of what I was doing when the boys of my generation were in college, listening to idiot lectures and cheering football games and doing all the foolish and silly and useless things that college boys do. I was a young reporter on the street, and I believe...
How old?
18. I believe that a young newspaper reporter in a big city at that time led a life that has never been matched on earth for romance and interest.
Well, the general belief is that you were a born reporter, and I believe there's an interesting story as to how you got your first job.
No, the story's not interesting. I simply applied for it and got it. I never was a good reporter.
Well, you see, already there are legends. The legends are that you were offered to work for nothing and went out and came back with some big feature story.
No, I never got a scoop in my life. They were the things that were esteemed in those days. They never seemed to me to have any sense. Most scoops were bad stories, and they were always exaggerated and played up in an idiot manner. No, I wasn't a good reporter, except in one sense, that I worked. I was willing to work. I never shirked the job.
With what papers did you work?
I started with the Baltimore Herald, and that was the end of my experience as a reporter, because I became a Sunday editor very early, at 23, and a city editor right afterwards.
What and paper?
Same Herald. And hence, I did very little reporting after the age of 25. In later years, I went back to reporting as a kind of volunteer, but I did only things that were chosen by myself.
When did you begin your association with the Sun Papers?
1907, I should say. That's when the Herald blew up. I was then managing editor of the Herald, and the thing blew up under me. And I hear young reporters talking about the hazards of their life. I've been sold down the river 3 times in my life, and every time to my advantage.
Well, now, did you have a definite goal in view at the time you were working as a newspaper man?
No. I was so busy I didn't have time to do any thinking. I wrote short stories, and when I was 20, I wrote a short story that attracted the attention of Ellery Sedgwick, later editor of the Atlantic Monthly. And Sedgwick took an interest in me and, in fact, offered me a job on a magazine he was then editing in New York called Frank Leslie's Popular Monthly. I refused it, but Sedgwick and I became friends and have been friends ever since. Insofar as anybody discovered me, it was Ellery Sedgwick. I see him very seldom in late year, but we remain on very good terms.
Now, at a certain point, you established a beachhead in New York in what you might call literary circles, and began commuting back and forth. How did you do that? How did that come about?
Well, in 1908, I think it was, I was offered a job of writing a monthly literary article for the Old Smart Set. That was one of many offers that I was getting in those days. I was getting fairly well known among the magazines, and they suggested things for me to do. I took it, because it didn't involve going to New York. I disliked New York and still do and didn't want to go there. Didn't want to live there. And I wrote that article for 6 years. And then the Smart Set blew up when the war came on in 1914. And, through a complicated series of events that are not interesting, George Nathan and I acquired control of the editorial department of it. He had been doing a little shorter than Wilde and I had, article on the theaters. And we ran the magazine as joint editors for 10 years. And it was very valuable to us. We had something that is a dream of every young writer. We had a magazine that we controlled and which printed everything we wrote without any interference by anybody else. That was an enormously valuable thing. Most of the stuff that I printed in the Smart Set in those days, and some of it attracted attention, could not have got into any other known magazine at that time. Well, in the end, we both got tired of it, and I did especially, and Smart Set had a bad title, which we couldn't change. It was short of money, and there wasn't any future in it. We had sucked out of it everything we wanted, so we decided to start another magazine, and we started the American Mercury, which was an enormously different magazine. The Smart Set was the most dreadful piece of printing in New York, and the American Mercury was the finest piece of printing that has ever been done in an American magazine. And, well, we lasted 10 years there, and I decided to quit. Because I've had a feeling all my life that 10 years is long enough for any job, that after that it gets more routinized, and the man really is tired of it, and I'd better clear out if you can.
Now, when you were associated with the Smart Set and the American Mercury, this great surge of vitality was taking place all through the literary world in America.
Yes.
The new writers were being discovered, some of them now famous, and you had a great deal to do with that, you and Nathan.
Well, we did our share of it. We were always especially alert for young authors. We discovered, remember, a great many who never amounted to a damn. They disappeared in their time. I should say for 10 authors that we hooped along, not one survives today. But among the survivors are some very good men. I was always credited with more part in that than I really deserved. After all, you can't discover an author who is not good in himself. The most of your so-called discoverer does is to recognize the fact that the man is good. The man was good anteriorly. And nothing that the editor does helps him. I'm thoroughly convinced that editors don't help authors. Either a man is good or he's bad. And if he's good, he'll bust through in one way or another. If he's bad, no conceivable help will help him. For that reason, I don't believe in teaching writing.
During the Smart Set and American Mercury phase, you were also quite active in the Sun through that column, The Freelance, that appeared every Monday.
Part of that phase. I started the Freelance column in 1911 and gave it up in 1915. 4 years. It overlapped the Smart Set phase during those years. I was either literary critic of the Smart Set or editor all that time. But that column I gave up for various reasons. One thing, it was a burden. I had too many other enterprises, and doing a daily column was a very severe burden, and I began to get tired of it.
Well, you went back to that column after a lapse of years.
No.
Under another title?
No.
Didn't you?
After the First World War, when the kind of stuff that I was writing could be printed again, I went back to the Sun to write a weekly article.
That's what I meant.
That must have been in...
Monday article.
Yeah, it must have been in 1918 or 19, and I kept that up to... Oh, I kept it up... 15 or 16 years, at least.
And it had a tremendous impact on the life of Baltimore, as you know.
I doubt it.
Well, I can speak from personal experience.
I may have had on you personally, but on the town as a whole, my opinion is that it hardly made a ripple.
Well, I was working as a reporter at the time, and I know that hardly a day went by A week went by when a bushel of letters didn't come in as a result of that Monday column. Letters usually calling you all kinds of names and disagreeing violently with everything you said, which was partly the object of the column.
The volume of mail that comes in to a magazine or a newspaper or a radio station is no index of anything, except that you happen to attract a lot of idiots, because most people that write letters to newspapers are fools. The intelligent people seldom do it. They do it sometimes, but not often. I used to, in my days running a column, I welcomed the letters that came in and, in fact, edited them. I was in charge of the letter column and always let anybody that denounced me violently get in, because it was, I believe, that people like to read abuse. And I didn't care what they said of me. I was much too vain to care what such idiots believed about me. In fact, I'd have been ashamed if they praised me. And so letters praising me very seldom got in that column.
Well, with uncharacteristic modesty, I think you're underplaying the influence of those Monday pieces on Baltimore. I came into the picture myself in 1920 as a young and somewhat starry-eyed reporter.
Yeah.
And at that time, and for the next 5 years, I mingled with the staff, with the underlings, and I know that you were regarded as a sort of a demigod, sort of a person up high up on Olympus who was in contact with all the literary greats, who was discovering novelists, who could have a novel published by a letter of recommendation, yeah, and so forth.
I think you're describing an unusual situation that might be almost described as pathological. The trouble with you is that you were an idealist, and you took that thing much too seriously, and certainly much more seriously than I did.
Well, many of the young men were idealists at that time.
Yeah, there were more of them. They were younger to begin with. Now you're an old man, just as I am, and I'm even older, and our idealism is out. Although I must say for myself that I never was an idealist.
It doesn't exist today among the younger members of the staff now. There's no such thing.
That's the
kind of spirit that we had, a kind of ambition.
One of the things that puzzles me about the modern young newspaper man is, what does he do in his leisure? He has much more leisure than did in my time and yours. I worked all the time. He works 5 days a week. What does he do?
Well, one day he plays poker or plays golf, and the other day his wife drags him off to the movies. Or he stays home and minds the children while his wife goes out and plays bridge.
Well, all those things would have been considered not only degrading, but impossible psychologically in my time. But the idea of a newspaper reporter with any self-respect playing golf is to me almost inconceivable. I hear that even printers now play golf. God almighty, that's dreadful to think of. I remember printers in my time. I knew a great many intimately. I always had to do with makeup on the papers, and hence I knew the printers. And I was very fond of them, and they were fine fellows. But golf playing would just seem as incredible as to hear of a printer going to a dance. Printers spent their leisure mainly in saloons, and in summer on the shores down the rivers below Baltimore. They were an intelligent man, the good ones. I learned a great deal more about the newspaper business from printers than I ever learned from editors. Great deal more. But now when you hear of a printer going out and dressing himself up and playing golf, the thing is really obscene. It's dreadful to think of it.
Well, the New Deal certainly had its effect in newspaper offices.
Yeah.
When you were a young reporter, and when I was a reporter, there was a great deal of freedom and camaraderie and low pay going with it and so forth, and long hours. I remember working from 1 o'clock in the afternoon till 11 at night, sometimes straight through. But the day the Guild
I did that every day.
Now we have a 40-hour week and so forth, and it has changed the whole characteristic, for better or for worse.
You could no more have a 40-hour week for a good newspaper reporter than you could have a 40-hour week for an archbishop. It's just not possible. A good reporter, he simply refuses to let a story go when he's got his teeth into it. And he wants assignments. I remember when I went down the office in the morning, certainly the thing that interested me wasn't whether I'd get a lot of time off and go home early, but whether I'd get some good assignments. Mm-hmm. If I got the good assignments, I didn't care how long I worked. I worked many a time all night. When the Baltimore fire happened in February 1904, I was a young city editor. They dug me out of bed about 11 o'clock in the morning. Said a big fire started downtown. I went downtown. I never got my clothes off or slept until Wednesday morning at 4 o'clock. That's from Sunday to Wednesday. I suppose that's almost a record for continuous work. I grant you that there were moments when I drowsed at my desk, but I never stretched out to sleep until Wednesday morning. And far from looking on that as oppressive or keeping an account of overtime, I was delighted with the opportunity. I was young, I was ambitious, and I liked the job. I get the impression from the modern reporter that he doesn't really like his work. He wishes he were a druggist.
Mm-hmm.
Or he wishes he had a good job.
Or a dramatist.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. The reporter with literary ambitions is one that I always respected. But most of the reporters that I encounter these days haven't even got literary ambitions. They never write anything outside the office.
Well, many a good reporter that we both knew has turned press agent.
Well, in my time, a press agent was looked on as a loathsome creature. Nobody paid any attention to him, and there was a rule on the Sun for many years that if a man ever became a press agent, he never could come back to the Sun.
Now he's a public relations counsel.
He makes
$15,000 a year.
Yeah, he's just as bad as he was before. The thing that distresses me about press agentry is a simple one. I have seen so many good men become press agents of one kind or other, and there's a subtle corruption of their minds that they never get over. They simply can't recover from that horror. They're engaged in, if they're good journalists, some of them are. Remember, the worst men didn't become press agents, but often the best. And, they know deep in their hearts that the thing is not a dignified trade. And they rationalize their necessities in one way or other, but they don't rationalize them enough to get rid of them. And
you covered some very large and interesting newspaper stories in your day when you were acting independently and choosing your own assignments. I remember, for instance, the Scopes trial.
Oh.
That was a lot of fun.
Oh, it was a lot of fun.
With an overtone of tragedy, don't you think?
Yes, it was a dreadful thing to think of presumably civilized people falling into such a slough. And it was a dreadful thing to look at a man like Bryan, a man with his opportunities in the world, to see what he had come to intellectually in his old age. It was a tragedy in a way, but I should add at once, it wasn't a tragedy to me. I wasn't suffering anything, I was enjoying it. I enjoyed it tremendously.
Well, who would not enjoy that remark, that famous remark of Bryan? You remember?
What's that?
When he said that man is not a mammal?
Yeah. Well, I see nothing remarkable about that, because that is the belief of a very large section of the American people. If they're actually Christians, they can't believe that man's a mammal. Personally, I believe he is. But I have no particular horror of the man who believes it isn't. He seems to me an amiably comic character, just like a man who believes that if you put a horsehair in a bottle of water, it'll turn into a snake. Or the man who believes that Friday is an unlucky day. I should add at once that I am one of those who do believe that Friday is an unlucky day. And like nearly all agnostics, I'm very superstitious. And I would no more undertake any work of importance on Friday the 13th than I'd jump off a house.
You are still an agnostic. You've held very faithfully to that.
Yeah. I was born an agnostic. My father was one ahead of me, and his father ahead of him. So agnosticism is nothing new to me. I'll point out one of the strange corollaries, and that is this. A man who is an agnostic by inheritance, so that he doesn't remember any time that he wasn't, has almost no hatred for the religious. I get on very well with all kinds of ecclesiastics and all kinds of pious people, because I don't have any evil conscience in the matter. I'm not a renegade.
No feeling of sin.
No feeling of sin, whatever. I assume that they've got a right to believe anything they please. Being an extreme libertarian and believing in free speech and every other kind of freedom up to the last limits of the endurable. I think there is a limit beyond which free speech can't go, but it's a limit that's very seldom mentioned. It's the point where free speech begins to collide with the right to privacy. I don't think there are any other conditions in free speech. I've got a right to say and believe anything I please, but I haven't got a right to press it on anybody else. For example, take, for instance, the Catholic Church, which I am on good terms with personally, but have no belief in whatsoever. I've got a right to print my dissent from its doctrines, to utter them. I have exercised that right for many years. But I have no right to go on the cathedral steps on Sunday morning when the Catholics are coming out of High Mass and make a speech denouncing them. I don't think there is any such right. Nobody's got a right to be a nuisance to his neighbors.
Or to hurt his neighbors' feelings.
To hurt their feelings wantonly. If they come to him and say, "What do you think of this Mass that we've just finished?" I think he has a right to answer. But he has no right to press his opinions on them. Well, of course, you'll notice the peculiar thing about the United States, where there is very little free speech. Free speech is a very limited right in this country, as I have learned to my bitter experience more than once. Yet it is a country where the right to press opinions on reluctant hearers is carried to a development that is unheard of on earth. The whole country is full of propagandists who are bothering everybody all the time. I get in the mail every morning tremendous piles of propaganda of one kind or other, and I can easily imagine a man who would resent that, would think it's a nuisance, and he ought to have there ought to be some way to save him from that annoyance. Personally, I don't care, because when I get propaganda and with it there is one of those reply played postal cards or envelopes, I always send it back empty without any writing on it. They have to pay 3-4 cents to get it back, and it's my quiet way of saying that for you.
Do you remember the Battle of the Century? The great prize fight in Boyle's 30 acres between Dempsey and Carpentier?
Yes, I covered it. I covered it for the Baltimore Sun and the New York World. There was a very curious episode, that fight, there were a lot of professional sports reporters there, and they were all unanimously in favor of Carpentier for sentimental reasons. Dempsey, it appeared, had not been a war hero, and Carpentier had. And while it was plain to a child who looked at him that Carpentier couldn't conceivably beat Dempsey, why, these reporters, some of whom were very good, constantly sought during the fight for evidences of Carpentier making some impression on Dempsey. And in the eighth round, Carpentier happened to hit Dempsey, who staggered a bit, as a man will when he's caught off his balance. And the stories the next day, some of them, all were to the effect that Carpentier had nearly knocked out Dempsey. Well, I was innocent and ignorant, not being a sporting reporter, and I didn't mention any such episode. I mentioned the fact that he'd been hit him, but reported that he hadn't made any impression on him, whatever. This developed into a controversy. And some of the sporting professionals insisted that Dempsey had been staggered. And after the controversy went on for a week or two, it occurred to somebody to go to see Carpentier and Dempsey. And Dempsey's reply was that he hadn't felt the thing at all. And Carpentier's reply was that, so far as he knows, he hadn't made any impression on Dempsey whatsoever. That is a wonderful proof, of which are many, that people believe what they want to believe. Now, the feeling against Dempsey at that fight was very bitter. And some of the sporting experts shared it. And another thing that I derived as a moral from the whole episode is this, that so-called experts are just ordinary men at bottom, and that you can't trust them, their judgment, in an emotional situation any more you can trust anybody else's.
Well, Dempsey went on, as you know, to live down his reputation as a draft dodger and became one of the most popular men in sports.
Right.
I think we should say that in justice to Dempsey.
Oh, without doubt.
Has been a pretty decent... And
there was nothing wrong with Dempsey.
He was badly managed.
He was badly managed. I know. I didn't hold anything against him on the ground that he wasn't a war hero. I wasn't myself. Dempsey, later on, kept a saloon in New York, which I often went into, which had good food and the best mint juleps ever served in New York. Old Edgar Lee Masters and I used to go in there and always drink a couple of those mint juleps. He charged $1 for them 15 years ago, and they were well worth it.
I don't think you'd better go on record as a mint julep drinker. Isn't beer your main...
I don't drink much beer. That's a legend. That's
I know, but I mean, aren't you? Haven't you always been a connoisseur of beer and a champion of beer as a drink?
Yes, I think beer is a cheap, excellent drink.
You were always making us thirsty during Prohibition by mentioning the better brands of European beer with which you were acquainted. I remember that distinctly.
I naturally, when I went abroad, drank the wine of the country. And if I was in Germany or Denmark, I drank beer. If I was in Italy, I certainly wouldn't drink beer, or Spain, or even France, although the German beers were always for sale in France. That was an exaggeration, my beer drinking. I'm actually ambibulous. I drink every known alcohol drink.
What was that word?
Ambibulous.
That's a very fine word.
I drink every known alcoholic drink and enjoy them all. And I've always learnt early in life how to handle alcohol and never had any trouble with it. The rules are as simple as mud. First, never drink if you've got any work to do. Never. If I've got a job of work to do at 10 o'clock at night, I wouldn't take a drink up to that time. Secondly, never drink alone. That's the way to become a drunkard. And thirdly, even if you haven't got any work to do, never drink while the sun is shining. Wait until it's dark. By that time, you're near enough to bed to recover quickly. I think the danger of alcohol largely consists of this. If a man starts to drink too early in the day or when he's got anything that puts a strain on him to do, as the alcohol goes out, or even while it's still in, he notices a letting down and he's tempted to drink some more, which removes that feeling of being let down. And the result is he gets on a wheel and he drinks too much. I am fond of drinking a reasonable amount. My doctor tells me that in his judgment, he's one of the best doctors in America, alcohol to a man over 60 is not only harmless, but a positive benefit. He said it has an effect on the heart muscle that seems to be very salubrious, and that the man who drinks a moderate amount, at least according to my program, is not only not harmed, but benefited, which is good news to me.
As you know, I myself evolved or degenerated into a dramatic critic. Yeah. Weren't you a drama critic at one time?
That's true. I was a dramatic critic for, 7 or 8 years. What's more, I was a good one, as I once proved to my old colleague George Nation, who looked on me as a mere amateur, and I dug up some of my old criticisms and showed that I was saying the things 10 years before that all the rest of the boys were saying then. For instance, I was not fooled by the frauds of that era. That was the era of 1905 to 1910, say. The country was full of them, all because of kinds of terrible plays that were being produced and taken seriously, plays by Augustus Thomas and Charles Klein. I always treated them as trash. There were stars at that time who were looked on with reverence by the public. I always treated them as trash. One of the great heroes of the time that I tackled once was Richard Mansfield. He was a kind of demigod in those days. And I told the truth about him when he played in a play called Don Juan by Schiller. He was playing an 18-year-old boy, and he was a man in the 50s. And he looked it. And it was a foul and terrible performance. Well, it got under Mansfield's skin, and he wrote me some letters and protesting and invited me to come to see him, which I never did. In those days, I made it a rule never to meet an actor if I could help it.
A very good rule.
Yeah, it was a good rule. I had nothing to do with stage people. I naturally knew some of them. Some of them I was very fond of. But I did not frequent theater society, and never in my life did I go to a theater party given by a manager to celebrate the opening of a new play. And
what do you think of the Newspaper Guild as an influence in journalism?
I think it's been I think the idea of the Newspaper Guild is good, but that the influence of the Guild has been bad, almost unqualifiedly bad, for the reason that it got in the hands of the wrong men, beginning with the first of them, Hayward Boone. As I said some time ago, I've been sold down the river 3 times in my life, papers sold or busted under me. It happened that every time, having been born lucky, it was a good thing for me. But I saw and knew intimately many men for whom it was a dreadfully tragic thing. And I always believed that the men on a newspaper, or any group of men, ought to have some machinery for compensating their individual impotence. I lived through the time when a old-time ice wagon driver city editor might come down in the morning with a hangover and fire a man simply because he was in bad humor. That is not theory. I've seen it done. I was a city editor and fired men, but I never did it for that reason. But I probably did it for reasons that were just as irrational. I didn't like the man. I believe that if a man works for any institution or industry for a given time, for a reasonable time, so that he's settled down into his job, he requires a kind of vested interest in his job. And it ought to be impossible to fire him wantonly and without compensation. All that I'm in favor of. I think that the man as a whole, as a group, can always bargain with the administration better than men alone. I'm in favor of that. But when the guild began to develop, it turned out very quickly that the guild was a conspiracy of the more incompetent and useless men on newspapers, not only against the boss, but also against the good men. That, like any other labor union, it began to be dominated by the selling platers. And it hence made its fight along lines that were, to me, silly. For instance, its fight to greatly exaggerate and increase the wages of office boys and of all of the third-rate people that hang around the edges of a newspaper staff. When I negotiated with the guild, as you may remember, I tried hard to separate the actual newspaper men from all these auxiliaries. I don't care. I think the auxiliaries ought to be represented. But they ought not dominate the guild. The newspaper men ought to speak for themselves. I never, as a negotiator for the Sun, objected to any reasonable demand made by the men. I don't know whether you remember that negotiation.
I do.
But I was always in favor of what the men, the actual good men, wanted, including some things that were expensive to the paper or seemed to me a little bit irrational. But nevertheless, I think a man is entitled to be a little irrational about himself. But when they began taking in girls who take want ads, telephone operators, and all such people, I washed my hands of it. I don't believe that's a newspaper guild anymore. It's just simply a gang of fourth-rate employees with the newspaper men as unwilling perfumers. I think the guild would be very well advised if it sloughed off all of those auxiliaries and went back to being a newspaper guild. It would then be dignified. The bosses would lose three-fourths of their arguments against it. And the higher administration on newspapers would be more friendly. Remember, the higher men on newspapers are nearly all men who have been active newspaper men. There are very few who it happened. I don't know anybody on the Sun papers in any executive position who hasn't been through the mill. Do you?
No, I don't.
A man that hadn't been through the mill would be a rather useless man. He'd never be chosen for his job on grounds of merit, be some extraneous thing. But the newspaper guild began making demands, particularly on the weaker papers. They seemed to delight in the fact that they had when they got hold of a weak proprietor who simply was helpless. They had strikes. They tried to ruin the man. And in the end, they did ruin a good many of them. And it's a curious thing that all of the proprietors who were most friendly to him at the start were the men that they picked on for a special persecution. For example, Davy Stern in Philadelphia and that fellow in St. Petersburg, Florida, who I don't know. I don't know him at all. But he reached a point where he could not operate his paper under the demands being made. And he had two choices. One was to fold his paper, sell it to somebody, or sell it to somebody. And the other choice was to fight him. He decided to fight him. He threw out all guilds and unions, although he was a sincere friend of unionism. He found there were a lot of old printers down in Florida who didn't, having tried for a while being retired, they didn't like it. They wanted to get back in the office and get a little ink on them. And he soon had a composing room staff, he found that there were many newspaper men who didn't like the Guild, but who did like working in Florida. Some of them came to see me when I was down there last winter, and they went down. He pays them fairly reasonable wages, and he's got his whole plant run by non-union people, and he's doing very well, and many other proprietors around the country are following suit, and I believe that some big city will make the break soon, and then you will see chaos. The unions will lose all they have gained by long years of work, particularly the typographical union, which was a very high-toned union, as you remember, run by men of intelligence, has lately got in the hands of extreme radicals whose main animating idea seems to be that the boss is a scoundrel, regardless of whether he is or not. That's a kind of a formal assumption that they make. And they're going to make it until someday the boss gets tired of it and throws them all out and keeps them out. There are papers at this minute that have no union organization whatever. One is one of the most prosperous papers in America, the Philadelphia Bulletin. Nobody in the Bulletin has to join the union. They have no prejudice against the union man. He can belong to the union all he pleases. He can work in the paper. They pay good wages. Always a little above the union scale. That is up to now, always a little above. I think the union scales and some crafts are getting so preposterous that there'll come a time soon when newspaper proprietors will simply refuse to pay them.
You have covered every national convention from way back, didn't you?
Not everyone. I missed some.
Both Republican and Democratic.
Yeah. Well, in politics, I'm a complete neutral. I think they're all scoundrels without exception. There are, especially that is true of the reformers. I've known politicians by the thousand all my life, and I'm here to tell you that the most pleasant men, and on the whole, the most honest of them, are what are ordinarily looked on as machine politicians.
That's enough for politicians. They shouldn't take up too much time for the...
No, that's enough for them.
At one point, at a certain point, you drifted out of journalism and other things into the field of scholarship in your studies of the American language as embodied in your books. Would you say a few words as to how and why that transition occurred?
That wasn't a transition. I never have been a scholar and never pretended to be one. My interest in American speech began in my young repertorial days. I'd listened to the testimony in police courts, and it was a level of society that was unfamiliar to me, and I was fascinated by it, and the talk of policemen and so on. And I began making notes about it and wrote a couple of newspaper pieces about it, and I found that a lot of other people were interested, and they began writing to me, and I accumulated material, and finally the thought occurred to me that it would make a book. And I wrote the book, and both my publisher and I believed that it had a rather limited appeal. We printed it in a limited edition, and the edition was sold out.
That was the American language.
First edition, 1918 or 19. It sold out so fast, and once it got out, the amount of material came pouring in so enormously that I was just forced to write another edition, and then another, and then another. And then it got so enormous that I had to write appendixes. But I never pretended to be a scholar. I was a sort of scout for scholars. I accumulated the material and tried to put it into a readable form so that people could understand it and to suck out of it whatever human juices were there, and there were plenty. And my hope and idea was that the material that I had accumulated and pre-digested in a way would be used by actual philological scholars. That hope was vain. very few of them showed any interest in it. Even today, the more tony ones seem to think that it's rather infradig to show any active interest in the language that 140 million people speak. They show a great deal of interest in obscure and nonsensical languages, which hardly anyone speaks, but they haven't yet brought themselves, I'm speaking of the tony ones, to studying the language of their people. That is not to be taken without qualification, because a great many of the younger ones have shown an interest, and they have maintained American speech for years. They've print books on the subject, and they do a lot of interesting work, but the thing hasn't been organized in the grand manner as yet. As long as the scholars fail to take it over, I've continued, because I can't help it. I have got enough material for 5 more volumes in my house at this minute. Now, I'm an old man, and I'll probably be an angel soon. I've got to think of what to do with them. And I have resolved to leave them to a library where anybody else who's interested can get them. And some of them, there are newspaper clippings, magazine articles, learned journals. I read all the philological journals. And an enormous number of letters, suggestions by people all over the world and of every rank. In my second supplement, the authorities referred to in the notes include an admiral in the Navy, a general in the Army, and 5 or 6 lifers in penitentiaries. They include newspaper men of every rank, from young reporters to proprietors. And they include every kind of person conceivable, probably to the number of 10,000. All that stuff is in my files, badly indexed, but still sorted out enough for a man to use it.
Henry, in all these years, you've been a fabulously busy man. Everybody knows that. You've always worked and worked. Your principal relaxation has been music, hasn't it?
If you can call it a relaxation. I devote very little time to music. My principal relaxation has been work.
Do you still have those weekly meetings with a group of other musicians?
They've been going on over 40 years. We're getting old. Some of our members are 80 years old.
You still play the piano?
Yeah.
For that group? How many are in the group now?
I think there are 11 at the moment. I play the second piano. I'm not good enough to play piano as a major instrument. I never practice, don't want to acquire a technique. I've always believed in early in life it's foolish for an amateur to get too good. He wastes too much time on music, and it becomes an obsession and a curse to him. I want music for pleasure, not as a labor. I don't go to hear music much, because I dislike sitting in seats confined for an hour or two between maybe unpleasant people, and having to hear stuff that I maybe don't want to hear. When you go to a concert, you've got to take what the professor offers. I go up to the Bethlehem, Pennsylvania every spring to the Bach choir to hear them sing Bach's B minor mass. That doesn't annoy me so much, because it's a pleasant trip in beautiful spring weather usually, and whatever they give on the first day, which is usually Bach cantatas, on the second day I'm sure of hearing something that I've chosen myself and that I want to hear. That is Bach's B minor mass. I believe everybody that loves music wants to hear it at least once a year. It's one of the great masterpieces of the world, and it's done very well, and the surrounding atmosphere is excellent. The town of Bethlehem pays no attention to the proceedings, whatever. They don't bother you. They don't put up any hot dog stands or try to sell you flags. Their hotels do not increase their prices. And it's happily free of every sign of American festivity.
By the way, what kind of a cigar is that that you're trying to keep lighted?
That's a cigar made in Baltimore that I smoke relatively rarely. I mainly chew it. I chew cigars while I'm working. I'm one of the last remaining tobacco chewers left in America, and I never chew chewing tobacco, but only cigars. And this is a good, clean cigar made of honest American tobacco. It has a pleasant taste, and it's not deleterious in any way, and I've done it for years and suffered no ill effects that I can notice. When I smoke, I ordinarily smoke more expensive cigars, but I don't smoke a great deal.
Just one more topic. As you know, at the present time, television has become a great factor in newspaper work. All over the country, newspapers are setting up television stations at the cost of $1 million or so, and there's a revolution going on among newspaper men who are brought into the new field. What do you think of television?
I think it's a curse to newspapers, and I wish it could be separated from them. I am sorry that the Federal Communications Commission did not prohibit ownership of radio stations by newspapers. I don't think it's a good thing in the public sense for any one agency to control rival news sources. They ought to be kept separate and in active rivalry. That's one objection to it. Secondly, human nature being what it is, as soon as a television or any kind of radio enterprise gets into a newspaper, an enormous number of men, including some of the best men, become radio crooners, not newspaper men.
They become actors.
Actors, yeah. They get stage struck, in brief. That's the truth. And it shows in the newspaper instantly. The way for newspapers to meet the competition of radio and television is simply to get out better newspapers. They can always keep miles ahead of these other agencies, which happened the machinery for doing what newspapers can do. Newspapers ought to print better papers. They're going downhill, and any time you find a newspaper that's got a radio department, you find a newspaper deteriorating.
What do you think of the actual programs on television that you've seen, apart from their connection with journalism?
I have seen very few. Those I have seen, I must say, are terrible. I had never realized that presumably sane human beings would waste their time looking at such stuff.
I take it that you haven't seen my Sunday night program.
Unfortunately, I haven't seen it. I hear it's wonderful.
I've taken the plunge. I've gone in up to my neck.
Well, you're another man lost to journalism, where you're a valuable man, in my judgment. I think you know your trade and do it very well. And this is not just an afterthought, because I've said it many times around the office.
Oh, thank you.
I think every moment you spend on television is at the cost of the newspaper.
Well, it has its compensations. When we get back to Baltimore, I have a day to interview a very beautiful actress over television, Diana Barrymore, John Barrymore's daughter.
That's pleasant, but since when have newspaper men not had that felicity?
Well,
when I was a young reporter, nearly 50 years ago, I used to interview beautiful actresses and get mashed on them sometimes. but I don't think that that's any advantage at all. I believe in Gresham's Law, bad money drives out good. And suppose a man were running a fine restaurant, which to me is one of the greatest of all human enterprises, one of the most socially useful things. A man that runs a good eating house is a valuable citizen. All right. He's running an eating house, and he notices that hot dog stands and lunch wagons are proliferating in the neighborhood, and he says, "By God, I better look out, or they'll fetch me someday." So he goes out and buys a dozen lunch wagons and opens them around the neighborhood, and he makes money. Nevertheless, I don't believe that that's a good idea. I don't think newspapers should run radio stations. I grant you that they may be profitable, although not television.
Well, I think in spite of all that you've said, I think you yourself are somewhat of an idealist. And on that note, we will close. We have to get back to Baltimore. By the way, what do you have to do today? What is your chore for today after we get back?
The rest of the day?
Yes.
I want to get in the office about 2:30 if I can. We got to get lunch somewhere along the way. And after that, I've got nothing pressing. I'm working on an article. I'll do that tonight if it's not so hot. You say you're going to close on a note of idealism.
Yeah.
That's, to me, catastrophe.